listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hey, folks, back for a proper podcast here. I'm Ed McGrogan with, once again, Steve Tigner. Monday, we're into November. We have said goodbye to the WTA season official. Well, that's actually not true, and I wasn't even doing that on purpose. There actually is another WTA event this week. For all intents and purposes, though, I think for this conversation, we will declare the season over with, of all things, an Agnieszka Radwanska victory in Singapore, and a pretty. We should certainly start with her, Steve, and you know, just, you know, she was on the brink of elimination a couple days before when we last got together. And from that point on, you know, put together, you know, two great victories, and probably wins the biggest title of her career.
Yeah, she won the matches she needed to win. I mean, she actually lost. It's not often that a round robin turns into triple elimination. Kvitova, Radwanska, and the woman she beat in the final, Kvitova, each had two losses. That's one more than the women they beat in the semis, Muguruza and Sharapova. So, you know, Radwanska won just what she needed to win and nothing more. But she was good. You know, she was really good through the last three matches. Basically, at the time when she thought her season was over, she had basically stopped practicing before her round-robin match with Halep, and she wins that. Really plays probably the best tennis she's played all year, really pretty vintage stuff for her. And then she continued that against Muguruza and Kvitova, I guess you would say, for Muguruza, she's learned maybe you don't play singles and doubles at this tournament. She was pretty tired by the semifinal. It's kind of amazing that she got as far as she did, even in that match.
Yeah, I did realize that Muguruza did both events here. You know, I can say it certainly is, I think, tough to say no to playing doubles, not only just for the point that you're with somebody and you'd be kind of letting them down in a way, but I mean the point's clear that it, you know, with an already kind of demanding schedule and it toward the end of the year, it was probably too much to ask, I guess, but you really wouldn't say that after the round robin stage of the tournament where she went 3-0 and even though Radwanska comes out of this with the victory and obviously wins the final match of the year, you know, Muguruza, I think you can only really take away some big positives from her from this event, from the last part of the year in general. We often, I think, see players who do well at one particular slam, we've seen so many players ride off of that result for the whole year, but you do like to see, after a little bit of a lull, you know, well after the Wimbledon final, which she reached, Muguruza ended this year on a high note, and I think, you know, her stock is certainly way up there going into 2016.
Yeah, maybe the lesson is don't try not to qualify in both events if you can.
Easier said than done, yeah.
But Muguruza, yeah, no, I think the story of the tournament itself is Radwanska seeming to come out of nowhere and playing such good tennis to win, and also beating a couple of big hitters, Muguruza and Kvitova, that she doesn't usually beat. She lost to Muguruza four times this year. She has a bad record against Kvitova, but she kind of turned the tables on them finally. But the real story going into next year is Muguruza, her late season, her finishing number three, winning three matches here, even if she didn't win the fourth, and actually, in a way, acquitting herself pretty well in the fourth match. You know, that's the thing that we'll probably remember the most as the new season starts. But with Radwanska, it's harder to say. She started the year so poorly, lost in the first round at the French, and you know, was down to number 14 in the rankings. Now she has the biggest tournament of her career. I mean, you can see what it meant to her. She was in tears afterward, I think, surprise and kind of amazement to finally break through. She's had some tough losses late at Grand Slams, 2 3-set losses in the semifinals at Wimbledon, loss in the final there. I think she, you know, she may have been getting to the point where she thought she wasn't really cut out to win those kind of tournaments. So that was a great moment for her. We'll see what it means. I mean, she was back playing pretty much the best tennis of her career over the weekend. You know what that means and how much she can take from that into 2016. We'll see. But it's good, you know, as far as entertainment goes, it was great to watch her, you know, watch her playing that way again.
Yeah, and you know, especially, you know, we've definitely seen with Radwanska, with Muguruza as well. I mean, they're going to do, and for Kvitova as well, I should say, you know, another semifinalist. They all play their best at Wimbledon. They all have games that are very well suited for grass court tennis, but they also, you know, these players have great games for really all courts, truthfully, and you know they've done very well on the hard courts that characterize and take up so much of the calendar as well. For any of these players projecting forward, it's always a bit of a caution, especially now that the women's season has a bit of a longer off season than you know, in recent years they've ended the year right at the end of October. So you're getting about a full 2 months of recovery and of really distance from this past year before we, you know, look ahead to the following season. And I wonder really if that's something that as nicely as Maria Sharapova's, you know, run here was too, that we'll have to kind of consider in the back of our head. You know, it's I almost think in a way that Sharapova's it was almost just nice to see her playing again after such a prolonged absence, and really just a, you know, you did feel on tour when Sharapova was not there at the U.S. Open and in many of the other tournaments that, you know, there was something clearly missing there, and it was good, you know, just even for, you know, 1 week here to, you know, to see that back. And but you know, I'm more bullish on someone, you know, like a Muguruza, even without, you know, clearly the Grand Slam winning experience going ahead into 2016, as I am of a Sharapova, who it seems that every time we are ready to kind of put her back, you know, most directly in comparison to Serena Williams, you know, that's we just end up having pie on her face and kind of wondering why we had this talk in the first place.
Yeah, I guess the positive for her is that, you know, we hadn't seen her for so long, and for me, I'd, you know, sort of started to wonder, is she going to get back to where she was? She's, you know, she'll be 29 next year. And then to see her play so well with sort of the same intensity as always, and to talk about how ready she is to get back and get ready for next year, you really felt like, okay, she's going to be a factor next year. Of course, Serena not being in Singapore, it allows Maria to shine a little more, puts a lot more, you know, she's the star. But it was, you know, it was good to have her in that role. What that means, yeah, you're right, Muguruza is the better long-term story. I just wanted to mention, Radwanska had 5 unforced errors in the final against Kvitova, a 3-set match in which Kvitova had 53 unforced errors, which is not abnormal. But Radwanska played that, you know, sort of that type of match, 5 unforced errors.
That's amazing. 5 versus 53.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see if that, you know, that's not something she's going to do every time. But you know, it was, if she deserved, you know, she deserved the win.
Yeah, and you know, one more thing while we're talking about this tournament in particular, and of course we have the men's World Tour final coming up down the road. I always wonder if, you know, from a perspective here, it always seems to me that, you know, I think where we are in the little tennis bubble that we occupy, you know, we can have views of tournaments that are completely, you know, at odds with the mainstream view, the you know, the typical view of a general sports fan about tennis. And, you know, I think I could ask about 100 people if they were even aware of the season-ending championships for the WTA, or when it comes to the ATP, you know, about that event, and I would say about 98 of them would say, you know, this is something I clearly didn't even know about, didn't really care to follow at all. You know, do these year-end championships, are they doing enough to give themselves sort of the status, the importance that you would think that they clearly deserve. I think the concept of bringing the top eight players for a round robin is good on paper. I wonder if, you know, it's almost sacrilege to think of extending an event, but does an event like this need to be like a 2-week tournament? Maybe you invite a couple more players, have a better round robin sample. You know, does it need to be played in does it need to rotate around the world as it's gone? Do you think these year end tournaments are really doing enough to kind of showcase really what should be an important end to the year?
I guess I think they do their best. They do a good job of building something that's not an event like the traditional event that everybody knows, like the Grand Slam. They, the women, it's really focused on tennis. You get a good match, or you get a sort of high quality, big name match each time, and there's no real sort of outside interest other than the matches. So in a way, it's focused. It's a great event for a serious tennis fan. You really do, if you watch a week of it, you really get to see all the players. You see them more than once. You really get to feel like you've gotten to watch them and see their games well. I'd say the negative is for something like Singapore, and maybe the ATP has been through this and come back where they try to expand the game, tour tries to expand the game in Asia, and you end up with much less recognition here in the US and in Europe, the big markets. That's the sacrifice. The final was on here in the US ESPN2 at 3 a.m. Like you said, there was not much awareness of it. And there wouldn't have been probably even if Serena Williams had played.
That's true.
But the ATP came back to London after being in Shanghai. They decided they wanted to, really do the best they could in their biggest market. I think that was a smart move, and I think that's paid off, and the event has been, bigger and has had more attention than it ever has. Maybe the WTA with the new president thinks about that. I noticed he said that they want to grow Asia, but the tour also wants to grow all the markets. So maybe he's sort of thinking, he said they didn't want to saturate Asia, Steve Simons. So maybe he's also thinking about something like that. Otherwise, I personally like the events the way they are. And I think they do their best to make them as big and sort of glamorous or glitzy as they can. I don't know what else could be done. It's a little like the Davis Cup. I think the Davis Cup is great, but then there's also, you look at it and say, well, it could be more, but you wonder what exactly they would do. From my perspective and the perspective of tennis fans, I think they're good events.
Yeah, they certainly are. I think, as you say, that they're so unique compared to everything else on the year that, in a way, that of course sets them apart too and gives them, certainly a different type of following, a different type of significance than we see otherwise in the year. As I said, ATP will wrap up its year this month. We're down to just two events left, really. We have the Paris Masters this week. We'll have a week off, and then we'll have the ATP World Tour Finals in London. That field is actually already set. There's no movement that could be impacted by Paris aside from an injury. The real story there is I think just seeing particularly what Novak Djokovic, if he is can continue to build on what's clearly becoming one of the most historic years in the game. And we'll see where that takes him. Is there any early thoughts perhaps on Paris? I know you'll be writing about this a little bit tomorrow, but any early just sort of, perspectives on the latest Masters event?
I guess when I'm thinking about Djokovic and what you mentioned, maybe it's Djokovic 2015 versus Federer 2006. If he wins all of his matches from here to the end, he'll finish 83-5. Federer in 2006 finished 92-5, and then you can kind of talk about them which one is, you can really sort of say which they're very similar and which one is the better one. You know, Federer ended up winning the last year's events. Can Djokovic close it out? You know, there's no real need for him to do that. He's got number one for the year, and this, if anything, he'd probably rather win London than this one. But that's the one, you know, sort of, that's the one little bit of intrigue is, you know, can Djokovic really close out this year the way he's played it the rest of the year?
And I don't believe Federer has Federer won Bercy. This might be one of the few that he has not won.
I think he has
recently won it.
I think he's won it, and I'm going to say I think Rafa hasn't won it, but
yeah. And you know, of course, Roger, Rafa, they as we'll you know, make this our final talking point, of course, was what I think was a very, you know, you saw Roger and Rafa in the Basel draw earlier this week. You know, they've been in the same draw before. They never met in that tournament. I thought this match really delivered on really kind of all the levels that you want to see. I thought that, it was, I think, a very competitive, well-played match. First of all, Federer wins in three sets. I think it had that feel that it was something a lot bigger than just, you know, an October ATP 500 final. I think both players recognized that this was the first time and really sort of embraced it, that this was the first time that the two were meeting in Switzerland. You know, they've met before in Spain and Madrid, maybe one other place, but certainly Madrid a few times, and Federer has even beaten Rafa in Madrid before. And you know, I thought that sort of came out in the way these two played. You and I both wrote about this a little bit, and you know, we both actually started with thinking about really the last time that Roger and Rafa played. It's been almost two full years, and their careers really have gone in very different directions since then. Federer coming off a very, you know, what seemed like kind of the season that was going to take him out of the game as we knew him. Rafa really coming off of a multi-slam year. And since then, you know, the two have gone in different directions. And I thought this match was really enjoyable from start to finish. It kind of, in a way, reminded me or gave me the impression that this might be the type of match that we're never going to see at the U.S. Open, where you would have such a heavy Federer crowd. And I thought both, you know, both men did themselves very well this week. And, you know, to borrow what I think you might say is that, you know, this would have been a pretty tough loss for Federer to take. And, you know, he gets it done in the end.
Yeah, he felt like this was one he, you know, he really wanted, or he almost had to win. He's been better this year, the last 2 years. He was at home. This was an indoor hard court. He won the first set. He had a good chance and had chances in the second. And then he looked like he had chances in the third, and then it looked like Rafa could sneak it out. And maybe that's what you would have expected judging by their past, but Federer, you know, closed it out well. But I think Nadal played the best match I've seen him, one of the better matches he's played this year, the best match of this week. He just was a different player because of maybe his knowledge of Federer's game and what he needs to do. He has very specific purpose and almost a different way of playing. He doesn't even need to think as much when he plays Roger. He knows exactly what he needs to do. And I think that came out, and you know, he said he felt like he played well and he was happy with it. And it made me think that you know, in 2014 maybe we thought Federer was going to continue to go down and Nadal would dominate him from then on. That didn't happen. And then maybe this year we would have thought, well, Nadal's on the way down and now Federer is going to continue. But maybe now after this match you look at it, well, they both could look good for, you know, at least another year, if not more. Federer is talking about 2018. There's no reason to think now, looking at Nadal this fall, that he's not going to come back and play. He's not going to come back and play well and challenge. He's still number six in the world. The one thing that let him down at the end was his forehand, which has let him down this year, and it did at the end. Maybe that was the difference, that he wouldn't have missed a few of the forehands that he did. He didn't come up with quite have the answers that he has against Federer in the past. we'll see if he ever, you know, we'll see if just that's the way he plays from now on. He's just not quite what he was, or whether he's on his way back to something better.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall the takeaway, kind of looking at the, you know, we've mentioned a variety of players in the Big Four era and where their careers have gone at various points, and the theme to me is that these guys are, all of them are so good enough that we kind of have to expect the unexpected from each of them. I think we've written off pretty much everybody at a certain point or other. Murray, Djokovic, you know, Djokovic never going to capitalize on his great potential. He's done some obviously amazing things since then. Roger and Rafa, we've had the obits written by various people at various times. It's what I think has made this group such a, you know, such an impressive bunch, not even just when they're, you know, when they are playing well, which is often, but, you know, when they have not played well, when they've gotten into these prolonged slumps, they've inevitably been able to get out of them. And I think, you know, we mentioned earlier about Muguruza looking ahead to 2016, you know, the Rafa 2016, and even the remainder of this year for him, I think is very compelling to see where he goes from there. And I think we'll leave it at that, because we'll have more time to discuss the last men's events of the year later on. So for Steve Tegner, this is Ed McGrogan. Thank you for listening to the Tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.